Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at a world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Bedell, and I'm your host. On today's program, going from unlicensed community radio to licensed community radio, it's the tale of Brattleboro, Vermont. Once home to Free Radio Brattleboro, now home to Brattleboro Community Radio. We'll hear from Larry Block, who is a volunteer with both stations, and hear more about how this community was able to maintain true community radio. And of course, we'll catch up with what's going on in our media environment with a little bit of headline news. Do stay tuned. Well, now, certain instances of the F word on TV are not necessarily indecent nor worthy of a fine. That's according to a ruling by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals on June 4th. The court threw out indecency fines against Fox and also struck down the FCC's policy of issuing fines for so-called fleeting expletives, which the court called, quote, arbitrary and capricious, end quote. The court said with the fleeting expletives policy, the commission had, quote, failed to articulate a reasoned analysis for its change in policy, end quote. The change in policy occurred when the FCC decided to reverse itself over its ruling on the use of the F word by U2 singer Bono during a live broadcast of the Golden Globes on NBC. Initially, the FCC found that the incident did not merit the fine because the use of the word was fleeting and not sexual or excretory in nature. Then, unexpectedly, the commission decided to reverse itself, deciding that the incident actually was indecent and merited a fine. The Second Court of Appeals did not address the overall constitutionality of the FCC's indecency enforcement policies, but did remand the other fines back to the commission for better justification. In several pages of the decision, the court also expressed the opinion that it would be difficult for the FCC to make its fleeting expletives policy pass First Amendment scrutiny. The court acknowledged the Supreme Court precedent that finds content regulation in broadcast to be constitutional due to the uniquely pervasive character of radio and TV. However, the court also wrote that, quote, we would be remiss not to observe that it is increasingly difficult to describe the broadcast media as uniquely pervasive and uniquely accessible to children, and at some point in the future, strict scrutiny may properly apply in the context of regulating broadcast television, end quote. Strict scrutiny is the most significant and strongest amount of scrutiny that the court may apply to judging a decision. In forming its new fleeting expletive policy, the FCC argued that the F and S words are inherently sexual and excretory by their very nature, and therefore always indecent, even when used in contexts that are neither sexual nor excretory. The court rejected this reasoning, writing that it, quote, defies any common sense understanding of those words, end quote. The court cited NBC's argument that, quote, even the top leaders of our government have used variants of these expletives in a manner that no reasonable person would have referenced sexual or excretory organs or activities, end quote. NBC cited President Bush's remark to Prime Minister Tony Blair that the United Nations needed to, quote, get Syria and to get Hezbollah to stop doing this S, end quote. And Vice President Cheney's widely reported, go, quote, F yourself, end quote, comment to Senator Patrick Leahy on the floor of the U.S. Senate. The court also found that the FCC hadn't sufficiently differentiated between the incidents of fleeting expletives that it didn't find, such as during ABC's broadcast of an uncut version of Saving Private Ryan, and those that it did. Predictably, the major networks challenging the FCC, which are Fox, NBC, and CBS, hailed the decision. NBC called it, quote, a strong dose of common sense, end quote. Andrew J. Schwartzman of the public interest law firm The Media Access Project, which won the court decision striking down the FCC's last revision and loosening of media ownership rules, said of the fleeting expletive ruling, quote, score one for the First Amendment, end quote. The FCC was less sanguine. In a statement, Democratic Commissioner Michael Cobb said, quote, this decision is disappointing to me and to millions of parents and concerned citizens across the land. But it doesn't change the FCC's legal obligation to enforce the indecency statute. So any broadcaster who sees this decision as a green light to send more gratuitous sex and violence into our homes will be making a huge mistake, end quote. Yet the reality is that the FCC has not released any indecency fines since the court challenge began, and so the court's decision likely will further slow down the FCC's enforcement of broadcast indecency. At this point, the FCC has the option to either follow the directives of the Second Circuit, appeal it to the full Second Circuit, or appeal the decision directly to the Supreme Court. And that's a bit of what's going on in our effing media environment. This is Media Geek. I'm your host, Paul Riesmandel. Check it out online at MediaGeek.net. Next up, we're going to hear from Larry Block. He is a volunteer with Brattleboro Community Radio in Brattleboro, Vermont. He was also involved in an unlicensed station there called Free Radio Brattleboro. And actually, I profiled the station several times in the early days of this show, going back to 2003, when the station, which had been operating at very low power with great community support there in the small community of Brattleboro, Vermont, was finally contacted by the FCC. And I think it's a great story where there was a city, a town that was able to engage in the sort of civil disobedience of pirate radio, of unlicensed radio, to bring community radio to the city in the time before low power FM existed, when community licenses were very difficult to get, and then was nevertheless able to transition from that unlicensed station to having an actual licensed low power FM station. So now we'll listen to Larry Block, who can fill in much, much more of the story.
Back in 1997, I don't remember where the idea sprang out of, but notice was given to the community that there would be folks gathering at our local teen center, as it was then called, to discuss the idea of a community radio station. And all would be, everyone was invited to come and participate in these initial discussions. And indeed, that's what I did, and maybe three dozen or so people over a period of a few months met informally at first just to sort of discuss the idea, and then it became more formalized, and people went about doing some of the advance work to research, well, what it is that you need to do as a community to create a community radio station. What is a community radio station? How do you engineer it? How do you get licensed to do it? How do we, as a group of people, move forward to make decisions? And all of those conversations occurred among a very motley group of folks, from younger teenagers all the way up to elderly folks and everyone in between. And we came to an agreement to be a consensus-based decision-making body, you know, early on. That was important to us, a little unwieldy with a very large group, but we muddled our way through, even if it took a little longer to sometimes arrive at a decision. We thought consensus was certainly an admirable goal to guide us and to unify us, and indeed it was a pretty good process and continues to be at Brattleboro Community Radio. Anyway, during our research period, we discovered the sort of brief history of the Federal Communications Commission, the Telecommunications Acts, and came to the understanding that there was no licenses, there were no licenses available for low-powered FM broadcasters at that time. And indeed, the FCC had abandoned that process, that licensing category, back in the late 1970s. And when we were faced with the reality that getting a license was not possible for a low-power FM community station, we came to the consensus agreement that we would forge ahead nonetheless, believing that it was a reasonable right for a community to have a low-power FM station, and that the mandate of the Telecommunications Acts indeed required the FCC to make that type of radio broadcast available, and that they chose not to do that did not stop us from moving forward in the most practical way possible. And so during the course of the next year or so, I don't remember exactly how many months it took, we went about separating ourselves a little bit into groups that could work on some of the tasks to build a community radio station. Certainly one of those was finding out what equipment we could afford raising a little money to afford broadcasting equipment. And in July of 1998, Radio Free Brattleboro went on the air for the first time. I don't remember exactly how many program hosts we had when we initially went on the air, but it was a pretty good group and a pretty diverse group and a pretty interesting variety of shows. I think we were broadcasting at about a third or a tenth of a watt. Maybe it's even less than that initially, because that's all we could afford was a very small power transmitter. And we broadcast out of the Teen Center in downtown Brattleboro. So that was our first studio. And as time went on, we were able to afford a slightly higher powered transmitter, which was better suited for our broadcast because the little tiny one that we had really didn't reach the whole town. And we weren't really fulfilling our mission, which was to bring independent, all-access, non-commercial radio to the community and to encourage everyone from the community to participate at whatever level they were interested in doing so. And indeed, I think early on we had a 9-year-old and broadcasting as a program host, and school groups, municipal leaders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Radio Free Brattleboro was pretty successful in terms of being able to sustain itself. It was a all-volunteer station. No one was paid to do any of the work. Because we decided not to do on-air fundraising, we didn't think that was practical in the small outreach that we had. We chose to do a combination of fundraising events, which we did all around the community, which were events that were fun events to do. We would host musical events, particularly in different rooms around Brattleboro. We would do yard sales and car washes, etc. And we also had an internal program where every program host that could afford it, and we didn't turn anyone away, would pay a small monthly dues to help us raise enough money to be sustainable. And that was the model that we followed for all of the years that Radio Free Brattleboro was on the air. And we went undetected, I guess would be the right word, by the FCC for several years. No one bothered us, and we didn't feel like we were bothering anybody. In order to be reasonably regulated, we turned to ourselves and our community for guidance on regulations, if you will, since we weren't licensed by the FCC. And we adopted what we inferred were community standards for our broadcasting guidance in terms of, similar to the rules, I guess, that the FCC has with regards to indecency and things like that. It was, and I may have my chronology wrong here in terms of the actual dates, but I think 5 years hence, in 2003, apparently reached the radar screen of the FCC for the first time. And I say apparently because I don't really know, what goes on at that agency particularly, but we received visit. I think we got a. Did we get a letter first? I don't think so. I think they came to our door and demanded to see our license. And we, of course, didn't have an FCC license. And in a conversation that I had with the, I don't know what their role was, the administrative office personnel from the FCC, a couple of them came, and I had a conversation with them, and we discussed the history of the FCC and the history of the Telecommunications Act, and the fact that it didn't make any sense that there was no licensing available for a 10-watt. We were a 10-watt station by that time, which turned out to be about the minimum level of power from based on our antenna location where we could reach the entire town of Brattleboro. We told the man from the FCC that we were authorized to broadcast by our community in lieu of the opportunity to have a low-power 10-watt LPFM license. There was no LPFM 10-watt license at the time, but there had been back in the 70s. And he was not really impressed by that idea, and we received a letter that instructed us to cease broadcasting or face dire consequences. Well, we met shortly thereafter. Of course, we had an emergency meeting of the entire staff, and we chose to voluntarily leave the air for a little while so that we could document properly the authorization from the community that we knew that we had, but that we actually had no real documentation at that time to demonstrate to the FCC. And the subsequent documentation campaign took a few months, and it was actually in three parts, but the initial outreach to the community was in the form of a petition. The petition was worded to ask the signer to authorize Radio Free Brattleboro to broadcast until such a time as the FCC got around to offering a license to another community entity that was prepared to continue the mission of independent, non-commercial, all-access community radio in Brattleboro. And that petition was signed by about 3,000 individuals. And when we finished that campaign in the summer, at the end of the summer, we chose to go back on the air, so expecting the FCC to return, which they did shortly thereafter, and once again demanded in a letter to see our license. As a matter of fact, the letter stated that it required us to produce our FCC license or other authorization to broadcast. Interestingly enough that the letter actually said it that way. It seemed to us logical that the other authorization to broadcast is what it is we were going to be able to give to the FCC. And indeed, when they returned to our studios, we offered them a copy of those 3,000 petitions, 3,000 petition signatures, which they declined and told us that they would be, you know, pursuing this matter legally, and we would be hearing from them again.
And you're listening to an interview with Larry Block from Brattleboro Community Radio, and you're listening to the story of Free Radio Brattleboro, the unlicensed station that first brought community radio to the community of Brattleboro, Vermont. You are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manell, and I am your host. We now continue with this interview with Larry Block.
And in January of 2004, we did finally hear from them again. By that time, we had been assisted by a local attorney, James Maxwell, who pro bono not only helped Radio Free Brattleboro in its subsequent legal defense, but being not a telecommunications attorney, went to bat for us by researching and learning a lot about telecommunications law and about the FCC and all that, so he could be of better assistance to us. We also contacted the National Lawyers Guild, and we're able to make an ally with them and a very wonderful attorney, Larry Hildes, who's out in Bellingham, Washington, was also sort of, you know, co-attorney for Radio Free Brattleboro when things got hot, which started to legally progress in January of 2004, when the U.S. attorney in Vermont sent a letter to Radio Free Brattleboro threatening us with a legal action and threatening us with fines, and I don't know if the letter threatened imprisonment or just whatever it is that they could threaten us with was in the letter, unless we immediately stopped broadcasting. To which our attorney on our behalf sent back a letter very nicely explaining the situation as we saw it, very nicely asking for the FCC to consider waiving the rules so that they could allow us to broadcast until such a time that they could issue us a license, which they have the right to do, as far as we understood their procedures. And that letter was unanswered. What happened instead was in March, there were lawsuits filed, I guess, if that's the right term. Actually, we filed first, anticipating that the U.S. attorney would file an action against Radio Free Brattleboro. In essence, what the government did on behalf of the FCC was ask the federal court to order Radio Free Brattleboro to cease and desist broadcasting. And indeed, our day in court came later that spring, where Judge Murtha heard a limited amount of testimony. It was not permitted to discuss the harm that we may or may not have caused to the community by a broadcasting without a license, nor was it permitted to discuss the harm that would be caused to the community should this community station no longer be able to broadcast. That was not permitted in the court. All that was permitted was a discussion as to whether or not we had authorization to broadcast. Given that scope, our attorneys called me as representative of Radio Free Brattleboro to the stand to discuss our understanding of how we got from there to on the air and why we thought it was okay to broadcast without a license. And there was a, you know, somewhat detailed transcript that discussed what we felt was an abandonment of the by the FCC of the Telecommunications Act. And essentially what I felt, and I think our attorneys supported, was that the FCC had not upheld the law in our view, and therefore we had sought a local authority to uphold the law in the vacuum created by the FCC's failure to do so. And that was our legal argument. We didn't feel we were breaking the law. Indeed, we felt we were upholding the law. And the judge took that into his, you know, consideration, those arguments. There were briefs exchanged and rebuttals to those briefs and so forth, and ultimately ruled that he would not issue the injunction sought by the U.S. attorney to order Radio Free Brattleboro to cease and desist broadcasting. Our interpretation of that was, at least inferred by the typical results of such a non-finding, was that there perhaps was at least a nugget of merit in our argument for the judge to consider further, you know, in terms of this case developing with more, you know, more comprehensively. And so that's what the judge did. He took the case and studied it and researched it for the better part of the next 10 or 12 months, during which time we were broadcasting on the air. And along comes early 2005, and without warning, the impatient U.S. attorney went to another judge, a magistrate in Burlington, Vermont, seeking not a cease and desist order, but seeking an order to allow the U.S. attorney and the marshals to seize the equipment of Radio Free Brattleboro. And it was an interesting maneuver, and that sort of sidebar is that maneuver did not sit well with the judge that had initially heard the case. Obviously, it was sort of an end run, a legal maneuver that was technically not a violation of the law because they were seeking a different remedy. The FCC has several remedies available to it, and this was a different remedy and therefore was not technically a violation of the law, although it seemed to everyone in town here that this was, you know, asking a person who's on trial and innocent until proven guilty to not be able to be sideswiped or blindsided by a legal action that indeed did occur in the early morning of, and I don't have the date in my head, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared with that, but the U.S. Marshals came early, about 5:30 in the morning, with the assistance of a locksmith, I believe, and broke into our studios and seized all of our equipment, effectively taking Radio Free Brattleboro off of the air. Well, concurrent with this all is that back in the year 2000, just to fill in here, the FCC, half-heartedly, I believe, and I think that we can look back and see that it's still a pretty half-hearted effort, finally sort of gave into what I think was a combination of pressures, including the pressures from nonviolent, you know, civil disobedient acts by community broadcasters, and began administratively to allow applications for 100-watt classifications of licenses. And Radio Free Brattleboro was aware of that opportunity to apply back in 2004 such a classification of a license, and we met and considered whether or not we would do that. The rules, though, being very, very weird, would have required Radio Free Brattleboro to stop broadcasting if we wanted to apply for such a license, with no certainty that we would ever get such a license and no timetable for having any idea of when a license like that might be forthcoming. So we chose to uphold our mission and not to to stop broadcasting with the wing and a prayer of maybe getting the possibility of a license down the road, a license that would have allowed us to broadcast with an FCC license, but would have certainly cost us up to 5 years, as it turned out, of non-broadcasting, as well as more expensive equipment that we couldn't foresee affording at the time. However, there was another non-for-profit organization in town, Vermont Earthworks, that had the foresight to apply for such a license because they believed that Radio Free Brattleboro's standing in the community was valuable but fragile, that we perhaps would not be able to continue for one reason or another. So they put in such an application for a license. And indeed, in the same spring when the U.S. attorney and the marshals seized our equipment, the FCC announced the award of a construction permit to Vermont Earthworks. Well, this had the effect of causing Radio Free Brattleboro to, after much consideration and discussions with attorneys, to not continue our legal argument. As much as we wanted to, when we wanted to take it all the way to the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., but our goal had been achieved in the sense that promised our community that if the FCC licensed another entity prepared to bring non-commercial, all-access community broadcasting to Brattleboro, that we would stand down. And indeed, that's what we did. You know, we essentially capitulated, not because we didn't believe that we had good legal argument, but because it was a moot point in terms of in Brattleboro, and we hoped some other community would be able to, if necessary, bring up those same legal arguments if it became necessary to do so. And we also were faced with the reality that pursuing that legal argument in court under the current administration's appointees in court would probably be a bit of a loaded deck against us, and we didn't want to prematurely raise an interesting new legal argument that might be better suited for a future test. So we voluntarily stood down. And over the next 18 months, or a little less than that, Brattleboro Community Radio, WVEW, was born. And again, with the same model as Radio Free Brattleboro, and is now broadcasting at 100 watts, and has been since September of 2006, with a roster of about 85 program hosts and 70-plus different shows. And it's just a wonderful thing that community radio continues in Brattleboro, and I guess I've come to the end of the story.
And that is Larry Block. He is with Brattleboro Community Radio, WVEW, 107.7 FM in Brattleboro, Vermont. You can check them out at wvew.org, telling us the story of how Brattleboro went from having an unlicensed free radio station to having a licensed low-power FM community station. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.